Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and here's a scary thought. You, on our website, in your Halloween costume. So let's do it. We are launching a Brian Lehrer Show Halloween contest called Scary Smart. We're putting up a photo page, and for this Halloween week, we invite you to post images of you or your kids or your really scary neighbors strutting your bewitching stuff. One mask I heard is selling well this year, by the way, is a Rudy Giuliani face with a cell phone on its ear. Judy, Judy, Judy. So whatever you and yours are wearing for Halloween, post it to our site, and let's all have a look. And we will pick winners from the following categories: individual costume, group costume, pet costume, outdoor decorations, that could be outside your apartment door as well, and extra points for interesting political content. We're not judging your politics. We're just judging how well you express your political content. Individual costume, group costume, pet costume, outdoor decorations, extra points for political content. Here's what you do. Save your photo as a JPEG or a GIF file and upload your Flickr account to your Flickr account and post it to this group. When sizing for the web, make sure it's readable and make sure to join the group. Let's see. What's the group? Oh, and the group on Flickr is called Scary Smart. Okay, so post your photos to the Scary Smart group at Flickr. We'll have some fun with this. All right, on a much more serious note, we're going to try now to sort out what to be afraid of and what not to be afraid of about the staph infection known as MRSA. Is this another overblown cultural fear taking hold when only very few people are actually at medical risk? Or is it the coming global pandemic that will be the next plague or something in between? We know this is a very big problem in hospitals, as we've talked about before on this show. But we'll focus now on MRSA in the general community. After a middle school student died in Canarsie, no one seems sure what to think is safe or how drastic precautions are needed to protect children and adults alike in any public space. So with us now to try to give us all some answers are Tara Parker Pope, who writes the Well column in the New York Times and their health blog, Well, and Priya Sampat Kumar, MD, professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic. Thank you both very much for coming on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Doctor, there's a distinction between hospital strains of this disease and community strains, I've read. Is that correct?
That is correct. MRSA is an increasing problem, but the number of community-acquired cases, the strains that generally affect young children, are still less frequent than the hospital-acquired strains, which have been a problem for several years in hospitals across the country.
For people who get MRSA, it's usually a very minor skin problem, not a systemic infection, I've read. Is that correct?
Again, it depends. Typically, the community-acquired strains do give you generally just a skin infection. The hospital-acquired strains, on the other hand, generally happen in people in healthcare settings, and those can range from anything from wound infections after surgery to bloodstream infections and can be very serious.
Tara Parker Pope, what kind of questions are you getting most frequently from readers of your column, and what do you think the biggest piece of confusion is or misinformation at this point?
Oh, well, there's so much. You know, I think my readers are really just sort of perplexed to know, is there anything really I can do? Is this a real, you know, we read so many scary headlines all the time. You know, we've read about SARS and bird flu, and that hasn't affected my life. So should I really pay attention to this warning, or is this just one more thing, one more headline, one more bit of media hype? I think that's the main question I'm hearing from readers.
In the hospital, it's passed through open. Well, first of all, let me open up the phones. Any of your questions about MRSA in the community, not in the hospital, which we did the other day, but MRSA in the community, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Give us a call. for our doctor and journalist guests, 212-433-9692. Doctor, in the hospital, it's passed through open wounds like IV sticks and other bodily fluids. How is it passed in the community?
In the community, actually, it's pretty similar. It is passed through open areas of skin, so and it can be fairly minor, so cuts, nicks in the skin, or abrasions, especially people playing team sports. Those are usually the way the bacteria gets into your system through the skin.
Team sports. There was an example that I read about where the St. Louis Rams football team had an outbreak of, I guess, the skin type of MRSA. Nobody got seriously ill from that. Is that correct?
Right, correct.
And so when does it become systemic and a threat to life, Doctor?
Fortunately, for most people with the community-acquired strains, what they usually get is skin infections, and these actually sometimes don't even need antibiotics. They just need a small incision and drainage off the pustule or the skin lesion. In some people who have some sort of immune defect, the infection can become systemic, and typically it happens in very young children or in older adult in the elderly. Those are the two groups where the infection can become systemic.
Mm-hmm. Well, the media is reporting now, Tara, each case of MRSA that they learn about, which gives the impression that it is a newly virulent threat beginning to spread. Is that the case?
Well, I think this has been, you know, around, as the doctor was saying, this has been around for a while. You know, community-acquired MRSA is an increasing concern, and I think what has really brought a lot of attention to this is a recent JAMA study that showed that 19,000 people probably die a year from MRSA. Now, about 85%
in hospitals.
Sorry?
In hospitals, right?
No, about 85% of those cases are hospital cases, but the authors, the JAMA authors, estimated that about 15% are from community, you know, in the community. And I think that's really kind of been a wake-up call for people. And, you know, there's this whole question, is this really just media hype? But, you know, I would tell you that, you know, 19,000 deaths a year is more than we see from AIDS. And I think we've all learned in this world where AIDS exists that we take simple precautions. You know, we don't handle blood. We expect our doctors to take simple precautions. And, you know, we take precautions in our life, in the way we live our life. And I think we've all accepted that. And it's not that we're in a constant daily panic about AIDS, but we're aware of it as a health threat, and we take appropriate precautions. And I think the thing with MRSA is that it's just time to rethink hygiene. And we should do pretty much the same thing. You know, we should think about where our hands have been and where we put our hands, and do we touch our face and our noses, and how often do we wash our hands. I don't think there's a need to panic, but I think there is a need to take this very seriously. This isn't just some headline that's not going to affect people.
Liz in Glen Cove, you're on WNYC.
Hi. And I was hoping and praying it was media hype. My son is in school right now. He's 5, and there is a case of MRSA in his school. Someone's being treated for it, and that's all that we know. And it's really hard to get a 5-year-old to wash his hands, especially when you're not with him. And I guess my question is, you know, what is that all that we can do? I'm just not even sure he should be in school today now.
Dr. Sampath Kumar, what do you think a school needs to do, especially when there's an identified active case?
Again, I think the thing to keep in mind is that kids are only going to pick up the MRSA and develop infection from it if they themselves have some sort of skin break. So for the mother whose child is in daycare, I would say, encourage him to wash their hands. And daycares and schools actually do a pretty good job, especially daycares, of encouraging hand washing. But the other thing is to pay attention if the child gets a boil or a pustule, to take him or her in and get it checked out. The only way to know for sure that it isn't an MRSA infection is to get a culture. So to be a little bit more careful about seeking medical care, but not to worry too much about something that might not happen at
all. And doctor, what do you think that Liz, our caller, should do as an individual?
As an individual, I don't think that there's any need to take the child out of out of daycare just because there was another case. There's probably more people with MRSA in the community than we know about, and so, you know, not going out in public isn't really an option.
Right.
And I'd say the same thing is true for not going to school or daycare.
Okay. I mean, there are often breaks in the skin. Like, I gave him Purell yesterday, and it stung his hands because obviously he had maybe a little scrape or something on his hand.
Yeah.
Now, that's just, you know, that's just a matter of course. So that's just to watch that for any sign of infection?
Right, exactly.
Okay, thanks.
And,
you know, watch the scrapes and bruises that kids always get to. The other key thing to watch out for is quite often these MRSA infections are mistaken for insect bites. So if they have a red spot that doesn't seem to get better in a day or two, to keep an eye on that sort of thing.
And Tara, in yesterday's Week in Review section, there was an article that said perhaps the greatest threat posed by MRSA is its ease of transmission. MRSA can pass from person to person through simple touch or the sharing of personal objects. It can navigate its way into the body through breaks in the skin, even microscopic ones, and through nasal passages. So that makes it sound like you don't even need to have some identified cut or bruise.
Well, and I think the thing is that we share a lot of germs every day, and, you know, they're all out there, and very few people, you know, on a relative basis have this problem. But I think the advice of just paying attention and teaching our children habits is what is going to be the best protection. You know, I spoke with a researcher who had a niece who had contracted MRSA, and he sort of did his own little investigation and found that she had been sharing a cell phone with a girlfriend at school, and that little girl's mother worked in a nursing home, so that was sort of, he traced it back, that was the source of the infection. You know, should you let your kids share a cell phone? I don't think that's really something to worry about, but, you know, I do think we should develop some basic habits, you know, wipe down a phone. You know, I advise my daughter not to use her friend's hairbrushes at school because, you know, head lice is always a problem. So, you know, we do these simple things as parents, and I worry about this too, but, you know, my daughter has a little bump, a little blemish on her arm, and I'm just watching it. I'm not worried about it. I think, you know, the chances are that nothing's going to come of it. But I also know enough from having written this and seen pictures of this, you know, infection, that if it does get red and oozy, if it does start to look bad, if it doesn't go away, I'm going to take her to the pediatrician, and then she'll be fine. You know, that's the thing. It's about just paying attention, you know, watching your kids.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. We're talking about the real risks and what to fear and not to fear from the drug-resistant staph infection, MRSA, with Dr. Priya Sampatkumar, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic, and Tara Parker-Pope, a reporter for the New York Times who writes their health blog called Well, and Sarah in Rego Park. You're on WNYC. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have three kids in school, and this morning I packed them all these little baby wipes, and the only baby wipes I can find are the antibacterial baby wipes because when they go to the bathroom, there's no soap. And I said, so take out the baby wipe before lunch and wipe your hands. But then it occurs to me that a lot of these antibacterial or these diseases that are resistant to our drugs are caused by us using so much antibacterial stuff. So I had this moment of doubt, am I doing the right thing, and why can't I just find them some soap and water instead of all this antibacterial stuff that I'm sending them away?
Right, that's a great question, and what a catch-22, Tara. On the one hand, we advise people to use antibacterial soap so they're a little more protected from the spread of things like this. On the other hand, it's the widespread use of antibacterial soap that contributes to drug resistance.
Well, actually, I should clarify, it's the widespread use of antibiotics that contributes to drug resistance, and that is where the biggest sort of problem is and where I think we can be the most vigilant and careful.
Uh-huh.
I do happen to be working on a story right now about all these different antibacterial products, and this is a question out there. Does the widespread use of antibacterial cleaning products, which are very
actually,
different
in the healthcare community, we don't recommend the use of these antibacterial soaps. Just regular soap and water works just as well at eliminating MRSA and other bugs as the antibacterial soaps. And one thing we promote heavily is the use of alcohol gels, the waterless hand sanitizers, that don't contribute to antibiotic resistance, that are very effective at cleaning your hands. They're actually gentler than soap and water, and as the caller pointed out, if soap and water isn't available, the gels that can be kept in a pocket, they come in little plastic containers, are great.
Derek in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Derek.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I think it was last week that there was a program with the former Lieutenant Governor Betsy somebody.
Betsy McCoy, yes.
I forgot her last name. Talking
about MRSA in hospitals.
Correct. And she mentioned these 5 or 10 things that are suggestions to improve the situation. And one of the items was medical professionals not wearing their scrubs to and from work.
Yes.
Right after the program that night, I sat next to a woman on the train, subway, that was wearing her scrubs, and I mentioned it to her. Her immediate comment back to me was that MRSA was a huge problem in her hospital and that several doctors and a couple of nurses had come down with MRSA recently. They just got a new memo on it. But in the memo, it didn't mention this thing about wearing scrubs back and forth. Secondarily.
Right. Now, I should say that Dr. McCoy did not make that recommendation, as I recall. A caller had brought it up as a concern that she had seen, lives near a hospital and constantly sees people going back and forth in and out of the hospital wearing scrubs, and she was concerned about the risk from that. Dr. Sampath Kumar, do you think that's a risk?
It can be a risk. Again, it depends on how good the healthcare workers are in the hospital setting. When they're taking care of patients, they are supposed to be wearing an additional gown on top of their scrubs if they're handling patient secretions. Now, we know that healthcare workers aren't always very good about doing that, and if there was any chance that they could have gotten, you know, blood or other kinds of body fluids on their scrubs, they really shouldn't be wearing at home. Both, you know, for other people around them and for their own personal safety.
So, yeah, Derek,
can I add that in defense of some doctors, I know I've talked to a lot of doctors, and not everybody does this, but a lot of doctors have a clean set of scrubs that they change into and out of. And so, I think it's an interesting question and one that probably ought to be addressed by the medical community. But I think every time you see a doctor in scrubs, I don't think you should assume that he or she is coated with MRSA, because I think they do take a lot of precautions themselves.
Derek, did you have another point?
I did, yes. The other thing, I think it was almost 6 months ago to 9 months ago, the JAMA report that you guys, your station reported on, mentioned one of the dirtiest items that doctors wear are the neckties, because they're very rarely clean and they go from patient to patient, sometimes incidental touch. The person I talked to on the train said she had never heard about the thing about neckties, but she could see it. By the way, it's not just doctors who shouldn't wear the scrubs or change the scrubs. I'm more worried about the orderlies and the less professional or less higher educated.
Right, any medical professionals. Either of you hear about this thing with ties?
You know, there have been lots of studies, and they've actually cultured ties, and the ties have been shown to have these organisms on them, but there's never been documented transmission through the ties because healthcare professionals don't flop their ties onto patients. But interestingly, in the UK, they just mandated that ties can no longer be worn in healthcare facilities. And they also said that scrubs, etc., shouldn't be long-sleeved, and there should be nothing below the elbow.
I always thought that ties should be banned from the workplace entirely. Now I finally have a health excuse to push for that. We'll continue with more information about MRSA and our two guests and your calls in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we get information about what to fear and what not to fear about the drug-resistant disease known as MRSA or MRSA, and your calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, for our guests, Tara Parker-Pope, who writes the health blog Well for the New York Times, and Priya Sampath Kumar, MD, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic. And Sylvie in Mount Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sylvie.
Not Mount Vernon, Putnam County.
Sorry, go ahead.
question, could your guests describe a little better what the skin irritation would look like? I have an 8-year-old who's on team football, and he's coming home with some bruises on his arms, understandably. Some of them have a little raised center to them, sort of like a boil, not exactly like a pustule, but then it's ringed with bruising. So I'm wondering if bruising at all shows up in what you're looking for in these boil symptoms.
Doctor?
What you really need to be looking for is something that is spreading fairly fast. So if you have a bruise and it looks stable over the next 24 hours, that probably isn't anything significant. If you have a little raised pustule today and about 8 hours later, it's gotten larger, and if there's redness spreading around it, then that is something that you need to have checked out by a medical professional.
Okay. Just quickly, I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as a boil, but there is a raise to the center of it, which is kind of odd. When I think of bruises, I don't think of that sort of center. And then as far as spreading, he does get a little dotting of some bruises around the bigger bruise. Is that what you mean by spreading?
No. What I really mean is that the central area is getting bigger, becoming more raised, and then there's sort of pinkness or redness spreading around it.
Okay, that doesn't sound like him, so I thank you very much for your time.
Yeah.
Sylvie, thanks a lot. Of course, he may come home with a concussion, but that's another story. here's neckties and kids playing organized football. Those two things should... All right, that's another show. Here's an email that came in that said, I heard recently that a tattoo shop in New Jersey had been traced back to a bunch of MRSA infections. I've also read about unlicensed tattoo artists spreading the infection. The nature of the industry worries me a bit, says this listener. Tara, have you thought about this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this question, I mean, I think the tattoo, you know, I just don't know how much information you can get about your tattoo parlor and how much, you know, you can look for the health inspector record and that sort of thing, but I just don't see tattoos as such a huge priority in life that we should be taking any kind of health risk. I'm not a fan of tattoos because I think there's a lot of questions about it. I mean, obviously, if you've got somebody that you trust and you see them clean their equipment, I guess if you're going to get a tattoo, I would ask questions about how much they care for, you know, the cleanliness and how they clean equipment and how they make sure that they don't transmit any kind of infection. I mean, hepatitis is a risk. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that's bad about that. So
yeah.
I'm sorry, all you tattoo fans out there, but I just... If you're worried about MRSA, you're worried about this, just don't get a tattoo. That's pretty easy to do.
Anything else on that, doctor?
Actually, there have been several reports over the last few years of tattoo parlors spreading MRSA. And as the other person said, it is certainly a risk factor, but when you're getting a tattoo, you can also transmit HIV. There's been reports of hepatitis C and hepatitis B being transmitted through tattoos. So there's a lot of health risks associated with body art in general, piercings included. So, again, you should be very careful about where you get these things done.
Well,
and several states have passed legislation, including my own state of Minnesota, tightening the rules with regards to licensing tattoo parlors.
Ramon,
for that exact reason.
Ramon in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ramon.
How are you doing?
Good.
I've actually contracted this thing twice in the last 2 months. And the only thing that actually comes to mind is I'm a commuter, so I'm in the gym 5 days a week, and the gym actually it's hard to get them to actually step up and take responsibility for it because they think they're being accused. They think, you know, I don't know what they think I'm going to do, sue them or something like that, but it drives me crazy trying to get the point across and just clean up.
Well, Tara, in the New York Times article on MRSA yesterday, and we can review, it said to avoid transmission, the agency, I think that was CDC, Centers for Disease Control, recommends frequent hand washing and showering after exercise, covering cuts and abrasions, placing barriers between skin and shared equipment like weightlifting benches, and sanitation of frequently touched surfaces. So that, to me, indicates that the gym might be a point of transmission.
Well, I think there is some concern about gyms. I mean, you have sort of moist and you know, conditions, warm, moist conditions. You have towels laying around, people sharing towels, you know, sometimes you try not to do that. But, you know, you look at the equipment and, simple steps, again, I don't think you have to panic or give up your workout. But, yeah, you know, throw a towel down. I don't quite know the answer about the handles on the machines.
Mm-hmm.
I know that to researchers who have found MRSA on the, you know, the handles, the grips that you use to when you use this equipment.
Yep.
Personally, I wouldn't want to walk around with an antibacterial wipe during my workout. But I think what you can do is say, you know, take the simple precautions, put the towel down, wipe it down, don't touch your face. If you have scrapes or, you know, abrasions, put a bandage on them, keep them clean, and then shower and
mm-hmm.
wash. And just, you know, again, I think basic hygiene. And most people who go to the gym don't get this problem, but obviously it's a breeding ground for all kinds of germs. And so I do think, you know,
you should think about it at the gym. It's definitely there.
Same thing with yoga mats?
Yes. And, you know, rather than waiting for the gym to clean up, I think cleaning up yourself would be the best thing. So do your workout and then shower right away. And most importantly, if you have MRSA, make sure you don't leave it behind at the gym. So cover any cuts, bruises, etc.
Doctor, before you both go, from what I gather, they're still scratching their heads in Brooklyn over how this 12-year-old at a middle school in Canarsie got MRSA because they can't find anybody else who has it in the school or what the means of transmission would have been. And understandably, that causes parents a great deal of anxiety because if there could be no apparent, you know, contact person or situation in which he came into contact with the disease in the first place, that leads to a very generalized worry. Any thoughts on how one child may have come down with it without any traceable, either other people with the disease or special circumstances?
I think the one thing to keep in mind is that a lot of people walk around with staph. One in three people have staph in their nose and on their staph aureus on their skin and nose. And about some of these strains are resistant. So you don't always have to have an infection when you have this, when you're carrying this bug around. So it's possible that this child had contact with someone who gave him the bug but wasn't themselves susceptible, and we don't really understand what makes some people be able to go through life carrying the bug in their nose and not getting infection and other people getting infection.
And we just have 30 seconds, Tara, but even as we were speaking, an email came in from the New York City Public Schools that says all families need to do, or from a particular school, that says need to do, besides being informed, is practice regular good hygiene, wash hands well, don't share stuff, keep an eye on cuts and scrapes. Well, don't share stuff. Try to get a fourth grader to do that.
It is impossible, but I think you can just teach your children basic hygiene. You know, and take simple precautions. Nothing is going to be 100%. You're not going to keep your kids from sharing toys. But I think you can teach them over time so that by the time they are teenagers and they are in high school and they really are, you know, sharing cell phones or in the locker room, they can have, you know, the basic information that they need.
Tara Parker Pope from the New York Times, Priya Sampat Kumar, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic. Very informative. Thank you both very, very much.
You're welcome.